Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the Procurement Games podcast and Open Conversations, where we pose the question, is the field ever leveled in our favor? Before I get started, I hope everyone had a great holiday and Christmas celebration. It was certainly a great time for gathering family and friends, despite the Omicron outbreak our country is experiencing. I hope that you guys stayed safe out there as we try to overcome this pandemic. It is 2022, y'all, and I am hopeful that things will be forward progressing for our minorities, women, and veterans. There is much to talk about and learn about relating to our small businesses, their journeys, and how we can strategize and improve our chances for the win. We have this infrastructure bill coming down the pipeline in every state, and we have got to ensure we have a piece of it and not just hear the plans that include us. Execution and implementation is key, folks, and that is what we need to pursue. My name is Arlen Pingle, and I am your humble host for the Procurement Games podcast and Open Conversations. As a Filipino-American, I share in the challenges you face in procurement, where agencies and private corporations continue to say they want to level the playing field. Our podcast is not a platform to gripe, but rather unite our voices to create change in how the public and the private sector should contract with us. Intent is one thing. Action and execution is another. This podcast provides a platform for minorities, women, and veterans to share their businesses, network with each other, but more importantly, support each other. We encourage the 30,000 plus folks who have downloaded our episodes to join us, comment, like, and share, because united, we make a difference without the risk of losing our businesses, being blacklisted, and not getting recognized for what we can perform as ready, willing, and able businesses. This podcast also provides an opportunity for trailblazers in the industry to share the innovative ways they are paving the way to make a difference in contracting minorities, women, and veterans. It is exciting to hear that there are folks out there championing a way for us to win. Each week, we present a small business and hear their journey of success and failures. We try to offer solutions and strategies for the win. We also try to provide the best content that is relatable to you, our listeners. Joining us today is the Chief Executive Officer and the President of Multron Builders. We have Babette and Patrick Buckner in our show. Babette, Patrick, welcome to the show. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing fine.
Good. Thank you for having us.
Excellent. Excellent. So let's talk about you. Give me a little bit about your background. How did you become an entrepreneur?
I wound up in construction as a result of wanting to help Patrick. When we got married, I worked for Target Corporation, and they actually were one of our first biggest clients that we were able to secure work from before I left Target. I was able to make connection with the construction department, and I think a week or two before I left, we were able to get on their radar, so to speak. And the rest is kind of history.
So that's going to flip me over to the president of Multron Builders, Patrick. Tell me a little bit about how you started, because it sounded like you're the entrepreneur.
You know, I come from a family of construction entrepreneurs, so I started off in very early working with my uncles, who were contractors, electricians, civil contractors, and framing contractors right here in St. Paul.
So it's family, right? It's kind of interesting. Most entrepreneurs begin either through, because it's ingrained through them, or they piggyback, they marry somebody who is an entrepreneurial, right? So Patrick, you've been more entrepreneurial. I have been ingrained in it. What did you love about it? What was your motivating factor to go, I'm going to jump in?
It's like a self-determination thing. And so nobody can limit you but yourself. I'm kinetic oriented, so I've always liked to manipulate raw material. And then I'm a preacher's kid too, so I can move, touch, and inspire people with my conversation, my ambition, my intention. So it just made sense for me to go the entrepreneurial route and do something I like. So construction to me is like a paintbrush is to a painter, or air to a bird, or water to a fish. It's just something that I naturally do.
Sure. It goes beyond the passion.
Yeah,
you do it with your eyes closed, as I like to say.
I do it even when the chips are down. Yeah. I still like doing it.
And so, Babette, your story is a little bit different. You were corporate.
It is.
Right? And then, so you see your husband here working and grinding as an entrepreneur, and it's very easy to kind of just look over across the way, perhaps, and go, okay, maybe I should do that, or maybe I shouldn't do that. Let's talk about that.
As I said, I was working at Target Corporation, and I was in management, and be done with my work, and then I'd go home and do the business, Moltron, and this was part-time at first. And I like to tell this little story, and I think it's all right, because I think a lot of contractors have this experience, and I've just learned this over the years. When we got married, Pat had a paper bag full of notices and letters, and he got a notice from the state of Minnesota. They were wanting to take a look at his records, and they were going to put a levy against his company for unemployment taxes. Come to find out, Pat had never had employees, but people that he had subcontracted with, once a job was done, would go and file unemployment, and he didn't open these letters. And so I came in, opened the letters, worked with the state of Minnesota, and got fines and levies that they were going to place against the company greatly reduced.
Substantially reduced.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very good.
From $100,000 down to $10,000, I'll just say. And so I'm saying all this to say that was before I even really started working with them. And one thing a lot of contractors need is that operations or administrative part that they really don't have time to do, or may not honestly have the knowledge of how to do it.
One of the things that we look at as small businesses is that foundation, that infrastructure, because we know we can do the work. I think I've said that in several podcasts. We can do the work with our eyes closed. But the challenge is sometimes we forget that there's a process outside of our world that needs to happen, be it the permits, be it the licensing, be it the bonding. Sometimes we are told we need to have it, but the back end explanation we don't understand, and then the next thing you know, we have letters.
Right.
And when we are the accountants, the marketing, the supervisors, the project sites, or we're actually the labor force, we don't open those envelopes. No. We just let it sit there. I know I've been guilty of that. I see it and it's like, oh, I'll do it next week, or I'll set aside Wednesdays as my bill days or administrative days. And then a project calls or a bid is let, and all of a sudden delaying it another week, and then that pile of letters just kind of stack up. So I think that's one of the hardest things as entrepreneurs, because we don't have that administrative support. And I think it's refreshing that you took that drive, that initiative, that leap to say, you know what, let me quit the corporate job and let me see how I can support, you know, Patrick. Which brings me to, let's talk about Moltron. What is Moltron? What is a core competency?
You know, we're general contractors, construction managers, and prior to starting Moltron, my trade experience, I poured a lot of concrete and did a lot of forming work. So the thing that a lot of entrepreneurs are scared to do, which is assert themselves and actually go out into the field or into the market and attract the business and convince corporate America, the feds, the state, that you actually not only can talk the talk, but you can walk the walk. That's something that I bring to the table, and that's something I'm very passionate about. And then at the same time, getting more people of color into the trades. I came up in the trades when there wasn't a lot of entry opportunities for African Americans, women, and other people of color. It was more the status quo, and so I was able to break through some of the barriers. And as a business owner now, I'm very passionate about helping more of us get into the trade aspect of it. It had very good benefits working in the unions, very, very good benefits for the family, for the person himself. So I'm pro-union, and I'm pro-allowing other or helping other people of color to make construction a career for themselves, be it in the trade side or on the administrative side.
And I do want to dive into the conversation of the union, because there are very few minority-owned union shops, right? Not just in the Twin Cities, but nationwide, even more so that are African-American or Black-owned.
Yeah, I peeped that very early in my union trades or in my union participation in my career, and that something that would set me apart from others is if I could weather the storm of getting vested into the trades and understand the quality controls that the unions represent and the scheduling that the unions represent from my production. So it was very critical that I, as a union member, got vested and have that to my credibility.
As a worker, you were in the union, mm-hmm. and then when you graduated through the workforce, let's mm-hmm. just say, and mm-hmm. started your entrepreneurship journey, you knew right from the start. Mm-hmm. So you were indoctrinated, in other words, mm-hmm. in the union realm. So your story is a little bit different versus never been in the union and coming in. You know, it's always admirable to see a tag team of man and wife. Mm-hmm. I'm a firm believer that's like the bestest partnership, even though people are like, no, don't go into business with mm-hmm. your relative. You know, it's strange bedfellows.
It is.
Right? It's strange bedfellows. Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason I have a degree in psychology, psychotherapy, is because I wanted to find out why people do the crazy things they do.
So Patrick has some crazy things
yes.
that he does. Is
and
that what
so
you're
do
saying?
I.
I'm a nutter.
It's called nutty nonsense.
Straight nutter.
And he has a lot of nutty nonsense. And so part of my journey into psychology was to really learn how to work better with my husband. Because it is difficult. I do want to say that. It's not a work in the park to manage your personal relationship along with your business relationship.
That's the crux. So we heard that the union is a unique factor mm-hmm. of Moultron. What is out there that makes you stand out?
One of the things I think is that we're women owned. That's one. And that we are a team. Like, our foundation is strong, so we don't have to worry about the support or the buy-in that either one of us have. We definitely want to see ourselves successful for ourselves, and so that makes us unique. And we bring that because Pat is a vested union member and has been in this town, or well, he was born in this town, but because he's worked in this town, he has a lot of relationships with people that are in key places now.
In my world, talking the talk was like worthless. It's walking the walk. And what the unions represented in construction in this state was some of the highest quality of production and end results that you can get. And at the same time, it was all about quality, 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 quality. And so for Moultron, if we can't do it at a high level, we won't do it at all. And if it hasn't been done at a high level, we're probably going to do it as a high level.
Right.
So the production, the capability of producing the results in a timely-like manner. So
it's performance.
It's all about performance.
And there's no sugarcoating it. Yeah, I see you guys as one where, you know, you're not afraid to say no to a project.
No.
I mean,
no.
You will scrutinize a project. And so that's, I think, our listeners would want to hear. You know, how can you be brazen enough to say no to that low-hanging fruit?
I've learned that some of the best jobs I've ever entertained are the ones that I don't do. And I've learned that, again, your network and your connections are everything.
So it sounds like Moultron strategically positioned itself in a, honestly, a power position where it can go up against that Goliath.
And that's where we're at now. And we're not up against them. We have formed, we're forming a stronger alliance.
Sure. The challenge that I see when, you know, procurement comes into play, you know, there are so many that we as small businesses have to learn. It's a different mm-hmm. process for the county. It's a different process for the city and the state and the feds. And there's really no one true way. Now, I understand they got to do it for accountability.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I think I'd like to mention, and I don't hear this spoken or talked about much, but I see it. I remember, I think when we first started working, I think there were like African American set asides, Asian, and different types. And then everything got lumped into women set aside and veterans, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And so then most women in construction, so let me just talk about construction, there aren't going to be very many women in construction. So that almost decimated any type of set aside for African American males, Latino males, Asian males, any male that was ethnic.
Yep.
Was like cut out, and it just became women. And then if you talk about whose table we're all sitting around,
the same people,
we all know
there.
That women included predominantly white women, because And so the same tables were getting the lion's share of the wealth. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but this is an aside and this is a joke. I see that white males are quickly becoming the minority, and I have a feeling that once they are truly the minority, then set asides will start working for white males.
And you know, in a previous podcast, we talked about how the system is perhaps killing two birds with one stone.
Literally.
Right? So let me dive into the union conversation, because we know that there is not a lot of us on the bench. Maybe they've done the best they can to recruit. There's that side of the fence on the workforce. Right. And then there's the entrepreneur side.
Right.
And we hear the stories about they don't send us the right people. They only have this type of workforce. It's only this. But most importantly, the union's too expensive. I mean, there's just no way I can afford to bring in somebody, because I've got to deal with fringe and so on and so forth. So
I do think the union is a great place to be for training. And one of the ways we have been able to work successfully with the union is to bring people into the union ourselves. I don't know how often we've even really called the union hall. We normally have people that have experience, and then we sign them up with the union. And part of their responsibility is to obviously make sure they do the training that they need to do and follow up. One of the drawbacks being an entrepreneur and working with unions is having jobs to sustain the people we bring into. And so as an entrepreneur, as you said, if we're bidding public work, local public work, there is no way we're going to be people that aren't union shops with work that needs to be done if it's a public entity that allows for non-union labor. And so in that way, being a union shop hurts us. We're going to price ourselves out of the market if we have to do a job at a union rate. Now, if the job is prevailing wage, it's not an issue.
Well, and that's the conscientious decision that an entrepreneur must make to mm-hmm. determine if they're a union shop or not. The notion or the perception out there mm-hmm. that it's expensive to be in the union because you've got the dues, you've got the fringe, that you got to continue paying mm-hmm. whether you have a job or not.
Fringe, when we employ people, then we pay their fringe. But if they're laid off, we're not paying fringes. And so a union worker is a direct cost of goods sold item. So it's going to be charged to the job. So I don't see it as expensive in that regard. I mean, that cost is going to be borne by the client.
What are you getting in the success contracting story?
One of the things we often have been able to do is in private construction, we've been able to let the client know that, you know, we may need some pre-construction, because there's a lot of upfront costs. We've done it to the tune of about $10,000 to $20,000, and that helps us set up the job. It takes care of the cost of the estimating, the project management, just a lot of the costs that oftentimes larger construction companies maybe don't charge the upfront costs, but we know that they're tail
somewhere
costs,
in there. That's
they're
right.
Going to make up those costs.
That's right.
And one of the things as smaller businesses we don't necessarily know how to do is be sophisticated in taking care of those costs.
That's one of those hidden things that as small businesses we don't pay attention to, that we can bill mobilization mm-hmm. or how to bill mobilization, because we're small, we really don't have, or not billing overhead. We as minority women, veterans, and own small businesses need to recognize that these are acceptable line items
yeah.
that they traditionally see. Now, we're not saying, you know, pillage and charge the maximum amount. Be smart about it.
Right.
You know, as much as we need to pass on overhead and bond costs and things like that, mm-hmm. a lot of that has to come upfront.
Mm-hmm.
And private companies are stronger at doing that. Government agencies are also great with increasing your margins. And that's the difference. Is it a profit margin or is it a markup?
Right.
And a lot of us don't understand the difference between margin and markup.
The other thing I can say in terms of success is we had a good mentor when we first started out. Then that mentor refused to give us fish to eat. We had to learn how to fish ourselves, which meant we had to learn the business of the business. So that when we were talking pre-construction dollars from our client or margin increase from our client, could actually break down how that would impact the actual job, the sales of what we were delivering, and how we're going to be responsible with either the pre-construction dollars or the margin increase. So you have to know your business.
Part of doing federal contracting is oftentimes they want you to have the experience of the work that you're getting ready to do. We didn't have a superintendent that had that experience, so they allowed us to approach our mentor and hire their soup for a few weeks, and our soup shadowed their soup. Pat said we had a mentor, and one of the things that pushed us to want to do the whole work, the whole jobs ourselves, is this mentor would pull out a sheet of paper and draw a line down the middle and say, okay, what do you bring to the table, what are we bringing to the table, and this is how we're going to divvy up the fee. And we were bringing jobs with a little bit of fee at the end because we weren't bringing a lot, and we never had another sheet pulled out.
You know, when you have a successful mentor relationship, mm-hmm. so that you can develop your own capacity,
right.
and your own capability, that's what a mentorship relationship is about. It's not a bailout.
No.
Right? And
no.
There has to be some structure in mentoring programs that benefit both sides.
Right.
And the challenge with a lot of mentoring programs that I've observed is it's a one-way street. It's the mentor dumping everything into the mentee. And that's not what mentor-mentee relationships are about. And until we change that model, it's
right.
going to hurt the mentee. And these big guys, you know, they hear mentor-protege programs, they're running the other way because they know it's time-consuming and such.
Right.
Rather than complimenting and supporting each other.
You know, with our mentor, we brought the clients to the table. We bought clients that our mentor couldn't even get. And the flip side, that mentor taught us how to service that client.
You weren't just siphoning. And again, it goes back to relationship building. I think that's one thing that is lacking. Are hesitant to show our flaws because we fear that we're going to get judged by them. But a true mentor will compliment and help add to the value that you're giving, so long as you got something to give in return.
Right.
Exactly.
Right? You're not dependent on them for jobs. And we, as communities of color, women and veterans, our lenses have got to shift on that. I'm entitled to get all this information from the big guy, mm-hmm. when in reality, it needs to be a partnership, an alignment of where we're going to go, because I can help you can help me mentality is what we need to enter. And not because it's a goal, not because it's going to make you look good
right.
In the check boxes and everything, right?
When preparation meets opportunity, you have success.
Right.
So a lot of people like to jump on the bandwagon of being an entrepreneur, and they're not even prepared.
So that kind of pivots me to our next question, is the failures. You have given us what we should do, what we could do to better ourselves.
My failures have been because I didn't listen. And when I did listen, I had it filtered through my fear, my guilt, my shame, my doubt, and the judgment that was embedded in me through my religious upbringing.
And I've been here to witness it all. As a Black American woman, I wasn't raised in poverty. So I didn't grow up wanting to show the world I could have more or I have more. I didn't suffer financially. When our business began to take off and cash was flowing, I didn't have the desire to spend money to make us look like a construction company. And I want to say that one of the failures was that, and I hope Pat doesn't mind me saying this, he wanted to make sure everyone knew we were a construction company. So one of the things he did was buy equipment and things that we had no job to charge them against, because he wanted to not just internally be a construction company, but show the world he was a construction company. And that is expensive. But I would definitely caution any new entrepreneurs to not run out and try to look like you are what you are. So make sure that you're mindful about the way you're spending money. So it's more important to run your business as a business and let any equipment or capital expenditures be paid for by the jobs that you're doing, or only purchase them if you need them to keep your business running.
One of the things in the last episode that we talked about is the primary colors of business, which is your marketing, your accounting, your management. and your operations. Take care of the house first before you jump into projects. Package yourself, represent yourself. Your experience and your knowledge and the fact that you can perform the work speaks volumes. That's what we have capability statements for. But we feel that our capability statement has to be laden with $1 million projects and $1 million equipment and $1 million bonds, when in reality, so long as we've proven that we can perform the work and do it well, we can build what we need to build. People can have the best website, the most beautiful cards and everything, and cannot deliver the work, which hurts us even more. So there's a fine line that we have to cross and ensure that we are representing, because at the end of the day, like Patrick said, if we are not listening to sound advice, if we are just going off what everybody else is doing, we lose our unique identifier. Let me pivot a little bit. What issues and roadblocks have you faced or do you feel is in the industry?
Right now, we're in the middle of BIPOC. BIPOC is the buzzword, and it's important. We've been here, most of us. However, construction is an industry that if you know what you're doing and do well, you can make a lot of money. So what I've been seeing of late is a lot of agencies are doing their best to get as many BIPOC firms into the pool of vendors. However, not all of these vendors really know the business.
They're not qualified.
No, they're not qualified. And unfortunately, that hurts us who are qualified and have been here for years, but because there was no emphasis or interest in working with us in the past, the stance that's been put forth is we just haven't been out here, which isn't true. No one was looking for us. I think it's important as the gates are opened in agencies and in private business to vet the people that you have coming in so that the narrative that we don't know what we're doing is perpetuated. Because there are a number of us that do know what we're doing and we are experienced. And I think it's the onus is on you all to make sure that you are vetting us and making sure that we can do the work that we're stepping forward to do.
So it's not a cattle call, right? And that's what's happening in the industry. It's not just in Minnesota. It's really across the board. There is a demand for BIPOCs. There is a demand. Disparity studies upon disparity studies have shown there is a lack of participation in the minority community, particularly for Black Americans. Mm-hmm. And we know that. Is this the right solution to just hurdle us all in simply because we are minorities or we are Black Americans? That system needs to stop because, in my opinion, it's setting us up to fail. We don't need to dance to their tune.
Right.
Let's get ourselves together. Let's get ourselves ready, willing, and able, and dare them to say no when we've got our stuff together, rather than just jumping in and saying, I'm one, put me in.
There's something else. Minnesota has been notorious for using people who fill the ethnic needs to play the roles of the contractor or the service provider who really doesn't know their business. And then with this whole BIPOC initiative, right, there's a divide and conquer type thing going on now. There's more programs for African immigrants than there are Black Americans who spent, everybody knows, about 400 or 500 years working in this country for nothing. And now we have people who look like us from a skin standpoint taking advantage of the benefits and the programs that were put in place as a result of the people who died and suffered in this country. And they didn't have any part of it. And when I say they didn't have any part of it, the immigrants from other parts of the world who are taking advantage of the benefits that our forefathers paid for with blood, sweat, and tears.
And one of the things that you look at is the silos, right? They're creating division among us.
Right.
And if we can't be united, then we're going to keep fighting. Fight for me being Asian and my rights as Asian and you being Black American and you being Hispanic and all that stuff. And if we are continuing to fight, then they're already winning, and we must recognize that. And one of the things that this platform has been able to do is unite our voices and unite the struggles that exist in each of the ethnic groups. And that's really hard. It goes back to my conversation before, where not only are they separating us by gender,
so that our minority males can go behind. Mm-hmm. They're also now creating it's already been there, always has been there, mm-hmm. the ethnic divide. And it goes beyond that. And then we're going to go into racial, and that's, you know, the black, the brown, and the white. So we have the racial, mm-hmm. we have the ethnic, and then now we're contending with gender. It's a tough thing when all we're trying to do is penetrate billion-dollar industries mm-hmm. and holding them accountable to their aspirational goal. Mm-hmm. Because if they gave us 10%, 20% of billions of dollars of industry, construction alone, infrastructure bill alone, there's enough money for a lot of small businesses to profit.
In the construction industry, there are several Black American-owned construction companies that have been in existence and fully capable of doing construction projects. But yet, we have African American immigrants who have recently come, companies, and they are now getting contracts. And it just boggles my mind. Personally, I don't understand how that's happening.
So to add to what Babette was saying, I think one of the reasons why Minnesota is embracing the African American immigrant is because they don't have the story that the Black American has in this country for the last 400 years of disenfranchisement, Jim Crow, slavery, good faith effort, all of the tricks and all the little, you know, high tech, political things you do to avoid looking at the reflection, the system, should I say, has been content with just keeping things the way they are.
What can the system do to make it better?
One thing I've seen over the years is on larger projects, conversations take place long before the projects are let. So invite us to the table before the project gets let for the big guys to come and portion out a small little piece to us. Make us part of the conversations. Let us know that there are larger projects coming out. I think Hennepin County recently did this at North Point. They attempted to set aside the project for Black American firms that were bid, and the project kept coming in over budget, so they wound up making it a regular bid job, which I still don't understand. And then they decided to break off smaller portions of the work to the Black American firms or firms that could bid on it. I understand that larger construction companies, often because of economies of scale, can do jobs at lower cost. It is going to cost a little bit more to work with smaller businesses sometimes because we aren't sophisticated enough to come in under budget and then later on build those additional costs or catch up those additional costs. And so that's also something that I think that the county needs to take a look at.
We're trained to be intimidated by whatever he has to say. He's the expert. He's so big. So, you know, why would we even question him? Whereas when the smaller minority company shows up, we got the middle managers who can't see themselves doing this. So how can you do it? Interfering with the progress of the small minority contractor. So, again, back to that invisible neon neck stuff, right?
And that's the hardship about the procurement games that are being played. I always talk about how the goalpost keeps moving when the game starts. And it makes no sense when they sit here and give us all the rules and regulations we must comply.
Anyone that's hearing this as a small business owner is to be that person that does what you know to do and doesn't think about what's happened before. And be aware of what's going on, but definitely do what you know to do, and in that, follow your intuition. Because there are cracks, there are holes that you can navigate through. So I don't want to give the impression that this is impossible, because I don't think we'd be here if it was impossible, honestly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, to add to that, integrity is everything. So it's not about, you know, the white man is keeping me down, or my baby mama won't work with me, or this, that, or the other. It's all about what you intend for yourself and your own life experience. So as big as the gap is economically between people of color and people of non-color in Minnesota, so are the opportunities for you to excel as long as you maintain your integrity about what it is you want to do. I just want to encourage you to, you know, don't quit. If you quit, your dream is over. You're out of the game.
Learn how to play the game so you know how to break the rules.
And that's the thing, right? Again, the conversation that we've had really not only recaps the current ecosystem, the current landscape, but it really just presents a different perspective through your lenses, because right. you guys have succeeded, you guys have failed, mm-hmm. and then you learn the game. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is if you arm yourself with enough knowledge, build a network that you can rely on, that can support you, that is advocating for you, then you're going to prevail.
Right.
And that's the beauty of what Moltran has done in this ecosystem, is really take the lessons that it has learned mm-hmm. and created a strategy, a marketing, and then executing it. Mm-hmm. And now you're in aligning of partners and mentors and such. Now it's a different game that you're playing.
Right.
And that's what I hope that our listeners will strive to do.
Right.
And with that, I want to thank our special guests for sharing their stories of success and failures. You know, there's always something that resonates with the struggles of minorities, women, and veterans in these conversations that we have. I hope that you, our listeners, learned a thing or two that will help you strategize for the win. Next week, we kick off our YouTube channel. Yes, where we discuss the last few weeks' procurement topics and take your comments and thoughts on our live stream open conversation. Tune in to Procurement Games on our YouTube channel Tuesday, January 11th at 9 a.m., where I will be joined by Jared Peterson, my co-host. Finally, I want to thank you, our listeners, for spending time with us. As always, I encourage you to go after that low-hanging fruit, but don't forget to look up and see the rest of the tree filled with fruits ripening for the taking. Strategize for the win, my friends. Until next time.